So we're thrilled that everybody's here tonight. We're looking forward to just an exceptional time. At 10 years old, Daryl Davis had a question. Why do you hate me when you know nothing about me? Daryl Davis became a highly regarded American R&B and blues musician, but this lingering question from his childhood put him on a radical and sometimes dangerous mission. He forged friendships in some of the most unlikely places. Grace Community Church is excited to host this musician, author, actor, lecturer, and race relations expert, Daryl Davis. As a musician, Daryl lights up the crowd with burning boogie-woogie piano. His energetic style has put him on stage with Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, Bruce Hornsby, and Bill Clinton, just to name a few. Daryl tells his thrilling first-person account of a black man's journey into the mindset of the Ku Klux Klan in his nonfiction book, Clandestine Relationships, which is set for re-release later this year. Davis has appeared on CNN, NBC, The Steve Harvey Show, and most recently in a PBS documentary now available on Netflix. Daryl lives in Maryland. While he's not lecturing or performing, Davis is an artist in residence at the Strathmore Performing Arts Center in Bethesda, Maryland. So this past January at Grace Community Church, we did a racial reconciliation series for 5 weeks. And to lead up to that for the Christmas season, we kind of did a preliminary of what does Christmas have to do with racial reconciliation. And what you'll find that most experts will say in this area is that proximity is everything. It's everything. And we see that in the Christmas story, God coming down to be close to us, to understand us. And this is the message of Daryl. So when we talked about that, so many people came and said, you know what, we've got to try to get Daryl Davis to come and speak to us because his message is so awesome. And so we have been hoping to do this for a number of months, and we are thrilled that we were able to book a date with Daryl Davis to come and speak to us tonight. So would you please help me give him a very warm welcome to Daryl Davis.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Well, good evening. I'm glad to be here this evening. And this story is as much about communication as it is about the Ku Klux Klan. And I want to give you all a little bit of background on myself so you'll understand why I've done some of the things that I've done and how I've come about doing that. First of all, I'm 58 years old. I'll be 59 next month. But I grew up as a son of parents in the U.S. Foreign Service. So I was an American embassy brat, traveling all over the world. Today, I'm a professional musician. I went to Howard University here in D.C. and got my degree in music. So between traveling overseas, playing different countries with my band or solo or what have you, combined with travels as a child with my parents, total, I have been in 53 different countries around the world on 6 continents. So I've literally been exposed to many, many different cultures, colors, ethnicities, nationalities, religions, etc. And all of that has helped shape who I've become today. You get assigned to a country for 2 years, and then you come back home to the States. You're here for 6 months, maybe a year, and then you get reassigned to another country for 2 years, and then back and forth, back and forth. So back in the 1960s, when I was in elementary school and living overseas and coming back and forth, overseas, my classes were filled with students, my peers from Nigeria, Japan, Russia, France, Germany, Italy, Sweden, Guatemala, you name it. If any of those countries had an embassy where we were assigned, all the embassy kids all went to the same school. That's how I grew up. If you were to look at my class, my classroom back then, you would say that looks like a little United Nations or something, all right? The one word that you would use today to describe that is multicultural. But the term multicultural did not exist back then. The term multicultural is still relatively new. I remember when it was multi-cultural. Now it's all one word, right? So, but to me, it was just the norm, all right? But when I would come home, back here, to my own country, I would either be in class with all black kids or class with only black and white kids, depending upon whether I went to the still segregated school or the newly integrated one. And there was not the amount of diversity in the classroom that I had overseas. That scenario overseas had about 12 to 15 years before it would come here to our country. Today, when you walk into a classroom, you see exactly what I saw overseas. You know, totally diverse. So I was living in the future when I was overseas. You know, and we were living in the past here. So I was already prepared for that kind of thing. Well, one time when I came back, I was 10 years old, 1968, and we had just moved to a place called Belmont, Massachusetts, which is a suburb of Boston, sort of like where we are is a suburb of Washington, D.C. And I was one of two black kids in the entire school, myself in fourth grade, and there was a little girl, little black girl, in second grade. So I really didn't see a whole lot of her because, you know, being a big, bad fourth grader, I didn't associate with the underclassmen, right? So consequently, all of my friends were fourth and fifth graders. And some of the guys, and they all were white. There were, you know, there was only the little girl and myself. A lot of my guy friends were members of the Cub Scouts. And they invited me to join. Sound like fun. I get to tie some knots, go camping. So I joined the Cub Scouts. On Scout Day, we had this march from Lexington to Concord, Massachusetts, to commemorate the ride of Paul Revere. Lexington and Concord are very close to Belmont. Out of everybody in the parade, the Girl Scouts, the Brownies, the Boy Scouts, the Cub Scouts, and whatever other groups were marching, I was the only black person that I could see up and down the parade route. The sidewalks on either side of the street were lined with mostly white spectators, flying flags and waving and cheering and carrying on. My den mother of my Cub Scout troop let me carry the American flag. And as I was marching with my fellow scouts, somewhere down the parade route, I began getting hit with bottles and soda pop cans and rocks and debris from the street by a small group of white spectators over on the sidewalk. I think it was like two kids and two adults, or maybe three kids and two adults, whatever. I just remember there were children and adults who were throwing things. And me, being naive, I thought those people didn't like the scouts. I didn't realize I was the only scout getting hit until my den mother, my cub master, and pack leader and troop leader all came rushing back and huddled over me with their bodies and escorted me out of the danger. And I kept saying, well, why are they hitting me? Why are they hitting me? And all they would say is, shh, move along, Daryl. Herb, move along, move along. It'll be okay. They never answered my question. So, you know, at the age of 10, if you have a question, you need answers. And if you don't get answers, you begin making up stuff to placate your own curiosity. So I'm thinking, okay, well, maybe it's because I'm the new kid on the block. I've only been here a couple months, you know, and they're testing me out. I had every excuse but the right one. So when I got home, my mother and father, who were not at the march, were asking me, how did you fall down and get all scraped up as they were putting Band-Aids and Mercurochrome and alcohol all over my arms and my face? I told them I didn't fall down. I told them exactly what happened. Now, for the first time in my life, my mom and dad sat me down and explained what racism was to me. At the age of 10, I had never heard the word racism. I had no idea what they were talking about. And, you know, I didn't have big brothers and sisters. I'm an only child. My parents got it right the first time. So, so if I had a question, my mom and dad always answered it or gave me the tools by which I could figure out the answer. If I had a problem, they would solve it or give me the tools so I could, you know, derive the solution to the problem. My mom and dad never lied to me. They always told me the truth. But on this day, in 1968 when they told me why I was being hit by these projectiles, I literally thought my parents were liars. I did not believe them. I didn't know why they were lying to me, but they were lying to me because people don't do things like that. I could not get my head around the idea that someone who had never laid eyes on me, someone who had never spoken to me, someone who knew absolutely nothing about me would want to inflict pain upon me for no other reason than this, the color of my skin. It made no sense. And these white kids and adults on the sidewalk did not look any different to me than my white friends overseas, whether they were my little French friends or my little German friends or my fellow Americans from the embassy, or for that matter, my white friends in my classroom who treated me very well, as did their parents. So my parents had to be lying because people don't do things like that. Well, I didn't believe them. About a month and a half or so later, that same year, 1968, on April the 4th, Martin Luther King was assassinated. And then this whole country went up in flames. Boston burned to the ground. Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, Chicago, my hometown, Detroit, Los Angeles, New York City, Richmond, all these major cities, rioting, burning, looting, violence. And while I did not understand why people had an issue with the color, with skin color, on both sides of the fence, I then realized that my parents had not lied to me. I knew they had told me the truth. But I didn't know why. Why do people have that problem? And yes, they have the problem. I see that now, but I don't know why. What is it? So I formed a question in my mind at that age. And that question was, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And for the next 48 years, because I'm 58 now, I've been looking for the answer for that question. I have not been able to find it. Well, one time when I came back, we're living up here in Potomac, Maryland. I went to high school in Rockville. 1974, I'm in 10th grade, age 15. We had a class called the POTC, which stood for Problems of the 20th Century. It was a senior class. I was taking it as a sophomore, 10th grader. And we had a great teacher who was always bringing in controversial type people to address the class. Well, on this day, in 1974, he had the head of the American Nazi Party come to our school, Thomas Wooten High School in Rockville, Maryland. Now, that would never happen today, right? We're talking the 1970s, where a lot of crazy stuff went on. For those of you, I'm sure some of you longtime residents here in this town know, but for those of you who don't know, the American Nazi Party was formed and headquartered right here in Arlington, Virginia. That's where it was created, by a fellow named George Lincoln Rockwell, right off Wilson Boulevard over there in Clarendon. That's right, exactly. Okay, George Lincoln Rockwell was a big proponent of the ideology of Adolf Hitler. And he came out of a laundromat one day on Wilson Boulevard over there and got into an argument with one of his Nazi members, who pulled out a gun and killed him right there on the sidewalk. And the organization was then taken over by his right-hand guy, his first lieutenant, a guy named Matt Cole, K-O-E-H-L. So on this day in 1974, Matt Cole and his right-hand lieutenant came to my high school in Rockville. And they stood up at the head of the class, like I am now, addressing the students, espousing the views of white supremacy. And Matt Cole looked at me and at another black guy in the classroom and said, "We're going to ship you back to Africa. And all you Jews out there, you're going back to Israel." I had never in my life heard an adult talk like that. And I'm thinking, where's this guy coming from? And, you know, my generation, we were, as kids, you know, we were raised to have respect for your elders as figures of authority. And certainly this guy was my elder. And while I didn't agree with him, I didn't want to just, you know, run him down or whatever. So I just sat there quietly listening to him. And somebody, one of my classmates, piped up and said, "Well, what happens if they don't go?" And Matt Cole said, "They have no choice. If they do not leave voluntarily, they will be exterminated in the upcoming race war. That was the first time I ever heard the term race war. And I'm thinking, I'm 15, I'm thinking, what is this guy talking about? The Civil War? I mean, that ended in 1865. You know, we're talking 1974, what's he talking about? And later that day, I'm standing beside my locker, and Matt Cole and Martin Kerr were there because they addressed a couple other POTC classes. And they were leaving the school, and they had to walk past me. I'm the only one in the hallway. When they got by me, they paused. They didn't say anything to me, but they stared at me and sneered. And then they started laughing and went on down the hall and out the front door. That was a trigger for me. I got to find the answer to that question. I got to learn more about this ideology. There were no courses you could take. There's no race 101. I mean, that doesn't even exist today. So I began buying everything I could find on black supremacy, white supremacy, anti-Semitism, the Ku Klux Klan, the Nazis in Germany, the neo-Nazis over here. I have a vast library of this stuff at home. And I've read it all because I wanted to learn about this ideology. I knew people were not born with it. And so where does it come from? Where is it going? How can it be addressed? So I went, you know, so I graduated in 76, went to Howard University, got my degree in music, and I graduated from there in 1980. So music became my profession, but studying race relations became my obsession. And in 1982, I had found out about an unpublicized rally or demonstration that was going to take place at noon down in front of the White House in Lafayette Park, right across the street. As you all know, if you want to protest something, you know, you go to Lafayette Park and you face the White House with your billboards and your signs and just stand there. There are people in that park 24/7, all different issues. And so the American Nazis were going to have this this silent protest, and they had not publicized it. I'd managed to find out about it through different channels. The police didn't even know about it. Now, back then, you could drive your car up and down the 1600 block of Pennsylvania Avenue, where the White House is. Of course, today you can't do that. You know, they got concrete pylons, so only law enforcement vehicles can do that. But you can walk up and down there. Well, I went down there, parked my car, catty corner to the White House over there on the other side of the park, and I waited. Here comes this black van. About 13 to 15 of these American Nazis get out of the van, and there's nothing that distinguished them as being Nazis. There were no swastika armbands or SS insignias or Gestapo-type uniforms. They all were in black suits and ties. Who did I see but my buddies from Wooten High School, right? Matt Cole and Martin Kerr, who came to my classroom and told me they want to ship me somewhere. So this is 8 years later, right? So I see them, and Matt Cole is getting everybody lined up on the sidewalk. And they're standing there. Now, there are other protesters in the park, too, protesting whatever they were protesting. And so nobody, you know, it's lunchtime, Washington, D.C., people walking by, not paying attention to anybody. Nobody knew that these were Nazis, except for me. So once they got all lined up, I had to confront Matt Cole. Because like I told you, I was raised as a child, you know, to have respect for your elders as figures of authority. So Matt Cole was definitely my elder, and I was a kid. But now, I'm an adult. So the dynamic had changed. He was still my elder, but instead of being child to adult, it was now adult to adult. Because I was 2 years out of college, so I was 24 years old, and I felt the need to confront Matt Cole about what he said to me some 8 years ago when I was a kid. So I walked right up to him, and I said, "Matt Cole." He like jumped back, like, "Who is this black person that knows me?" And he said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well," he goes, "Do I know you?" And I said, "Well, you spoke at my high school." And he says, "And what high school would that be?" I said, "Thomas Wooten High School in Rockville, Maryland." He looked at me and he goes, "Oh, yes, yes, yes. I remember you. That was a long time ago. What can I do for you?" I said, "Yes, it was 8 years ago." He goes, "Yes, yes, I remember. How can I help you?" And I said, "Do you recall what you told me?" He nodded his head, yes. And he said, you know, what can I do for you? I said, well, I'm still here. And he says, well, I can see that. How may I help you? And I said, well, you can tell me just who the heck gives you the authority to make permanent travel arrangements for me. And he says, what's your name? I said, Darryl Davis. He put his hand out. He shook my hand. And he held my hand in his hand. And he said, Mr. Davis, you have to understand one thing. It is in the interest of your race, the black race, to be a strong race. And you cannot be a strong race unless you are a pure race. And you cannot be a pure race if you are miscegenating with other races. It is in the interest of my race, the Aryan race, which is what he calls the white race, to also be a strong race. And we cannot be a pure race if we are miscegenating with other races. My race is committing genocide by miscegenating with mud races such as yours. We are becoming a mongrel race. So anybody who is non-Aryan or non-white is considered a mud race. So he's saying that they're becoming a mongrel race by miscegenating with non-pure. All right, so he goes on and on about this. Now, I wasn't there to beat him up or fight with him. I was just there to learn where this stuff comes from. So he went on and on. I wasn't buying it, but I was learning. So I thanked him, shook his hand again, and I left. That summer, in August, they had a national recruitment rally for the American Nazi Party. This was publicized because they had to get a permit and all kinds of crazy stuff. And so everybody knew about it months in advance. And people were protesting for the D.C. government not to issue the American Nazi Party a rally permit in Lafayette Park. Well, you can't do that because, you know, they have a right to freedom of assembly. They have a right to freedom of speech, just like anybody in here does. All right, so you got to protect those rights. So they got their permit. Well, they call this the National Recruitment Rally for the American Nazi Party, and they're going to hold it in Washington, D.C. So the cops, you know, made some kind of arrangement with them. They all met somewhere out in Peachy County at some undisclosed location. They got on a chartered bus, and they came to D.C. with a police escort. And all these police were around who had circled the park with their shields and batons so you couldn't get to the Nazis. So my secretary and I went down there. And there, we see the bus come. There, Matt Cole comes off the bus. Sieg Heil, Hi Hitler, white power. And he's taunting all the protesters. There were probably maybe 50 of these Nazis this time who had come from different chapters around the country, but there were over 10,000 protesters. And they came from as far away as New York, Baltimore, Richmond, wherever. And some of them came with chains and baseball bats and bricks and eggs and all kinds of other stuff to attack the Nazis. Well, you could not get to them. But because they had that protection with the police, they began taunting everybody. So the crowd would rush the police, and the police would push them back. Well, when that happened, they began throwing their projectiles over the heads of the police, trying to land on one of the Nazis in the circle. At that point, the cops put up the tear gas and began tear gassing everybody. And then people began turning over police cars. You can go on YouTube and look it up. You see it. Bashing out the windows, attacking the police. And the people went crazy. The police went crazy. My secretary and I were just standing there. And we got hit with a police baton just for standing there. So I said, come on, let's get out of here. So we leave. Then that evening, I'm watching WRC, Channel 4 News. And they're showing footage of the riot in D.C. I even see myself walk by with my secretary. And there's Matt Cole sitting in the studio. And he's commenting, you know, on the thing. He goes, you see, it's the blacks and the Jews that are destroying the police cars and denying us our rights. You know, they're denying us our rights to freedom of assembly and freedom of speech. You know, this government is being run by ZOG. ZOG, Z-O-G, is an acronym for Zionist Occupied Government. And it was then that I realized what Matt Cole was doing. As I said, he called this the National Recruitment Rally for the American Nazi Party. Why would he have that in Washington, D.C.? Washington, D.C., folks, as you all know, is two-thirds black. There are no black people in Washington, D.C. who want to be recruited into the American Nazi Party. And certainly there are no Jewish people in Washington, D.C., or anywhere else that I know, who want to be recruited into the American Nazi Party. So why have your recruitment rally here? I got it. Because he knew this violence, this thing would happen. And he had official footage. Official meaning network news. We didn't have cable TV back then, right? Just ABC, CBS, and NBC. He would take that footage of black people and Jewish people and whoever else attacking the Nazis and turning over police cars, wreaking havoc, take that footage and go to some town in some rural area and show it at his rally and say, you see what's going on in our nation's capital? You know, we need to take our country back. You know, we're being overrun by Zog. And that's how he recruits people. So that was a propaganda tool that he would twist and use to his favor. All right, so I learned all that. And then now Matt Cole died 3 years ago, and he was still going around the country giving lectures. Anyway, 1983, the next year, country music had made a resurgence in this country. There had been a movie called Urban Cowboy with John Travolta. And, you know, they brought that mechanical bull in and all these line dances and stuff. So all these bars or, you know, or clubs, you know, that were like top 40 bands, they switched over to country. And, you know, so if you wanted to work full-time in music, which is what I was doing, you had to play country. And I like country music. It's very easy to play. It's pretty much the same as the blues. And I joined a country band. I was the only black guy in this band. And consequently, I was usually the only black guy in many of the places where we played. Well, we played a place up in Frederick, Maryland, called the Silver Dollar Lounge at the Frederick Truck Stop. Frederick Truck Stop was located at the intersection of 270 and 70. Today, it's not there anymore. It's a Costco right there. Well, back when it was the Frederick Truck Stop, there was a restaurant, you know, the mechanics bay with the trucks, the truck stop motel, and the lounges in the bottom of the motel. Now, it was called the Silver Dollar Lounge. Silver Dollar Lounge was an all-white lounge. And when I say all-white, I do not mean that black people could not go in there. What I mean is that black people did not go in there by their own choice. And it was a good choice because they were not welcome. So here I was in the Silver Dollar Lounge. And the band, you know, it wasn't my band, it was my friend's band. The band had played there before. I was new to the band, I just joined the band. So they'd been there before, my first time in there. I came off the bandstand after the first set on break. I'm going to go sit at the table, you know, with my bandmates. And this white gentleman comes up behind me on the dance floor and puts his arm around my shoulder as I'm walking to the table. And I stopped and turned around to see who was touching me. And he says, man, I really like your all's music. I said, thank you, I appreciate that. Shook his hand. And he says, you know, I've seen this here band before, but I ain't never seen you before. Where'd you come from? I explained to the guy that, yes, this band has played here before, but this is my first time in here. He said, well, man, I really like your piano playing. This is the first time I ever heard a black man play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. Well, I wasn't offended, but I was kind of taken aback, like, doesn't this guy know where Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play? You know? And I said to the guy, I said, well, and I wasn't trying to be facetious, I was just being natural. I said, well, where do you think Jerry Lee Lewis learned how to play? And he says, what are you talking about? I said, well, Jerry Lee Lewis learned that style from black, blues, and boogie-woogie piano players. That's where rock and roll and rockabilly came from. Oh, no, 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 Jerry Lee invented that. I had never seen no black man play piano like that except for you. So I'm thinking, well, this guy's never seen Little Richard or Fats Domino or somebody, right? So anyway, we argued back and forth. I told the guy, I know Jerry Lee Lewis. He's a very good friend of mine. He's told me himself where you learn how to play. The guy did not buy that I knew Jerry Lee. He didn't buy that Jerry Lee learned anything from black people, but he wanted to buy me a drink. Now, I don't drink, but I agreed to go back to his table and have a cranberry juice. He had a friend sitting at his table, so he pulled his chair around to the other side, sat next to his friend, and I sat opposite both of them, right? He orders my cranberry juice, waitress brings it. He takes his glass, and he clinks my glass and cheers me. He says, you know, now this guy's like in his mid-40s. He says, this is the first time I ever had a drink with a black man. And I'm thinking, wow, you know, this guy's really having a night of firsts here. I'm trying to get my head around, how can this be? I didn't, you know, like I said, I was very naive. And I'm trying to figure out, how is this? In my 25 years on the face of this earth, 1983, I was 25. I had sat down literally with thousands of white people or anybody else and had a meal, a beverage, a conversation. This guy was in his probably mid to late 40s. He'd never sat down with a black guy before. And I know that there are black people in Frederick, Maryland, because I've seen them. So how is it that he somehow missed them? And so naively, I said, why? He didn't answer me. He stared at the tabletop. I asked him again. I said, why? His buddy said, tell him. I said, tell me. He looked back at me just as plain as day, and he said, I'm a member of the Ku Klux Klan. Well, I burst out laughing because I did not believe him. That's how naive I was, right? Like I told you, I have every book written on the Klan. I've read them all. And in none of my books does it talk about how a Klansman will come up and put his arm around a black guy and, you know, and praise his piano playing, want to hang out and buy him a drink. It doesn't work that way. So I figure the guy's, you know, jerking me around. And I'm laughing. He goes inside his pocket, pulls out his wallet, flips through, and hands me his Klan card. I recognize the Ku Klux Klan insignia, which is a red circle with a white cross and red blood drop in the center. So, whoa, this thing is for real. So now I stop laughing, right? Give it back to him. And we talked about the Klan and some other things, but he gave me his phone number. He wanted me to call him anytime I was to return to this bar with this band, because he wanted to bring his friends, you know, right? To see this black guy play piano like Jerry Lee Lewis. I'm not sure he called me a black guy to his friends, but nonetheless, he wanted to bring Klansmen and Klanswomen to see me play the piano like Jerry Lee. I said, okay, I'll call you. Now, we were there like every 6 weeks on a rotation with other bands. So I called the guy on a Wednesday or Thursday and said, hey, man, you know, we're going to be out of the Silver Dollar Friday and Saturday. Come on out. He'd come out both nights. He'd bring Klansmen and Klanswomen there, and they would gather around the bandstand and watch me play with the band, and then they'd, you know, get out on the dance floor and dance, you know, to our music. Not in robes and hoods, right? They came in regular clothes. So anyway, on the break, I would go to his table just to hang out with him, see what's going on. And some of them would get up and like quickly move away. They didn't want anything to do with me. Others would hang there because they were curious and wanted to meet me and talk to me or whatever. So those who ran away, that was fine. You know, when I went back on stage, they'd come back. Well, anyway, this went on until the end of 1983. And then I quit that band. And in 1984, I went back to playing rock and roll and blues and whatever else was going on in 1984, whatever other styles of music were happening. Well, then it dawned on me, wait a minute. I missed my opportunity because it just fell into my lap. I wasn't looking for it. I said, I should have asked that guy. He's a Klansman. How can you hate me when you don't even know me? Right? So I decided I'm going to write a book on the Klan. I'm going to go around the country looking for Klan members and leaders, and ask them that question. I'm going to start here in Maryland, where I live, go up north, come down south, Virginia, and on down south, the Midwest, the West, and get my answer. So now, this is like, you know, a few years later. And I had to track down that guy. I found his number. I called it. It had been disconnected. So it took me a couple weeks to track him down. I tracked him down. He didn't have a phone, but he had an address. He had moved. So there was no way for me to let him know that I was coming over to his place to talk to him, because I couldn't call him, right? So I went down there one Sunday evening, and he had an apartment. I knocked on his door. He opens the door. He goes, Daryl, what are you doing here? He steps out into the hallway and like looks up and down the hallway. Well, when he stepped out of his apartment, I stepped in. So he turns around, he comes back in. He goes, what's going on, man? You still playing? What's going on? I said, yeah, I'm still playing. But listen, I need to talk to you about the Klan. He says, the Klan? I said, yeah, you're a member, right? Well, he went on to tell me that he had since quit the Klan, and he gave me some long dissertation about why he quit. But anyway, I said, well, listen, where's all your Klan stuff? He says, what do you mean, my Klan stuff? My Robin Hood? I said, yeah. He says, well, they came and got it. I said, what do you mean they came and got it? Don't you own your Robin Hood? And then he went on to explain to me, which I later found to be true, you know, when you join, if you can afford it, you can buy the Robin Hood and other stuff, you know, that you need, you know, as a member. You can buy it outright, and it's yours to own. If you cannot afford it, you can still take it and go home with it, but you pay a little extra every dues period until you pay it off. Well, apparently he hadn't paid it off, so they came and repoed his Robin Hood, right? So he said that when they came to get it, he couldn't find the mask that went, you know, under the hood to cover the face. But he has since found it, and he needed to return it. I said, well, let me see it. He went back down the hall to his room or some room that was back there and came back and handed me this Klan mask. I'm looking at this thing. And I said, listen, do you know Roger Kelly? Yeah, I know Roger. Roger was my Grand Dragon. Let me explain to you how the hierarchy of the Klan works. Okay? Today, there is no such thing as the Ku Klux Klan. There used to be. Okay? There was one Ku Klux Klan and chapters of that one central Klan. Today, there are many Ku Klux Klan groups. There's no central Klan anymore. They all are autonomous, separate groups. And they all use the same colors on their robes that designate their rank. They all use the same secret handshake, the same passwords, the same titles, et cetera, and basically have the same bylaws. But they are separate groups. Like you might have the White Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Dixie Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, the Invisible Empire Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, on and on and on. These are all separate Klan groups. So, and basically, you know, if you see any of these groups, different groups together out in public, they will hold a united front. But behind closed doors, they are rivals with each other. They don't like each other, all right? Anyway, if you have a chapter of your particular Klan group in another state or in multiple states, you may then consider yourself to be a national Klan group. Therefore, you must appoint a national leader. Like we call our national leader what? President, okay. So in Klan terminology, that individual is known as the Imperial Wizard. Anybody who is prefixed with the word Imperial means that individual is a national officer, wizard being the top, like a president. An Imperial Claylif is like a vice president. So he oversees all the states in which you have a chapter of your particular Klan group. Then you have to have a state leader for every state in which you have a chapter. We call our state leader the governor. They call theirs the Grand Dragon. Anybody prefixed with the word grand means that individual is a state officer, dragon being the top officer. So a Grand Dragon would be like a governor. A Grand Claylif would be like a lieutenant governor. Then within the state, you have counties. We call that person the county executive. They call that person the Great Titan. Anybody great is on the county level. Within the county, you have districts, what they call claverns. We call a district leader, a mayor, a councilman, an alderman. They call that individual an exalted cyclops. And yeah. And at every level, you have secretaries and treasurers and chaplains and so forth and so on. And then you have your rank and file. So Roger Kelly was the Grand Dragon for the state of Maryland. All right, so he says, yeah, I know Roger. Roger was my Grand Dragon. I said, well, listen here, man. I need you to hook me up with Mr. Kelly. I'm writing a book on the Klan. I want to sit down and talk to him and interview him. Oh, Daryl, I can't do that, man. No, I can't do that. I said, well, why not, man? You're not in the Klan anymore, right? He goes, man, I cannot take a black man to Roger Kelly. You know, we both would be in trouble. I said, I'll tell you what. You said that you need to return this mask. He goes, yeah. I said, give me Roger Kelly's phone number and address, and I will go to his house, and I will return it for you. He said, "Fooped!" Snatched that thing right out of my hand. Said, no way. It was not going to happen. And he was very, very fearful, you know, that we both would be in trouble. And I had to beg and plead with him to give me Mr. Kelly's phone number and address. After 20 minutes of begging and pleading, he finally gave it to me on the condition that I not reveal to Mr. Kelly where I got his personal information. I said, okay. So I said, Daryl, do not go to Roger Kelly's house. Roger Kelly will kill you. And he told me about a place that up in Thurmont, Maryland. You all know Thurmont as being the home of Camp David, but it was also a headquarters for the Klan here in Maryland, one of the headquarters. So anyway, he told me about a bar up there that was a Klan bar, and the Klan would gather there every Saturday night if they weren't out of town rallying somewhere. So he said, you know, it's a public bar, anybody can go in, but he said the Klan hangs out there on Saturdays. When you first walk in, there'll be a row of booths off to the left. The first two booths closest to the door are reserved for the Klan. So that's probably where you'll find Roger Kelly and some other Klansmen and Klanswomen. He says, I don't guarantee that Roger Kelly will even talk to you, but you're safer to approach him in a public place than, go on his property. I said, okay. And he drew me a little map on, as to how to get there. Now, there were no black people living in Thurmont, Maryland. Every time a black family moved in, somehow or rather, a cross got burned on their yard. Or an interracial couple, cross got burned on the yard, so they moved right out. All right, so anyway, this is supposed to be on Saturday nights. I thanked him, went home, and I called my secretary, and I knew I didn't have any Saturdays available. You know, I'm a full-time musician, so I play during the week and most definitely on weekends, and I can't be taking a Saturday night off to go chase the Klan. So I figured that, Sunday is still part of the weekend. Maybe I might have, I also work on Sundays, but I might have a Sunday off. And I asked her, she looks at the calendar, she goes, yeah, you got this Sunday off and that Sunday off, whatever. I said, okay, I'm going to go up there and try to find Roger Kelly. Well, she wants to go with me. I'm like, no. And she's very insistent. Her name was Mary. She's very insistent, and Mary likes trouble, or likes to get me in trouble. And the only problem that that I had with taking her is that she's a white lady. Not that I had any problem with that, but I'm gonna walk into a Klan bar with a white woman. I'm sure to find the Klan, right? So, I didn't want to endanger her or whatever, but she was very insistent. So I said, okay, you can come, but you're coming at your own risk. So that Sunday rolls around, and we drive up to Thurmont. I follow my guy's directions. Perfect. There it was, right there. Boom, we're right in front of it. So we're sitting in my car looking at this place. There are like four or five little steps, a little stoop, and then the doors you go in. And so we're trying to figure out now, how does a black man walk into a Klan bar with a white lady? In none of my books that I have in my vast library were there any instructions for this. So I said to her, okay, I'm going to walk in first. You walk right behind me. When I get in there, if I turn around and face you, start running and I'll be behind you. So she says, okay, let's go. We got out, locked the car. We walk up the steps. I'm in front. She's behind. I open the door and I walk in. Well, the place was pretty much empty, maybe six or seven people there. First thing I see is this big Confederate flag on the back wall. And right over here, just like the guy said, is this row of booths. But all the booths were empty, including the first two that were reserved for the Klan. All right? Over here is this long wooden bar, and behind the bar is this long mirror. Scotch taped to the mirror is a picture of Roger Kelly. I recognize it because the Washington Post had done a story on the Klan, and I had the same story because I collect all that stuff. Somebody had cut it out and posted it on this mirror. So I knew I was in the right place or the wrong place, depending on how you want to look at it, right? So I'm looking around. I know what Roger Kelly looks like. I've never met him before, but I know what he looks like. So like I said, there are about six or seven people, a couple people back here playing pool, a couple people mingling around at the bar, whatever. I'm looking for him. Nobody looks like him, but not every person in Thurmont is in the Klan. Okay, everybody in Thurmont is white, but most white people in Thurmont do not like the Klan, and they want the Klan out of there. So I don't know if these people are Klan or not, but here I am standing in the middle of the bar looking stupid, basically, and I'm thinking, well, I just can't walk up to somebody and say, hey, excuse me, sir, are you in the Klan? but I'd driven, almost an hour and a half to get up there, and I didn't want to leave empty-handed. So Mary's standing beside me. I said, and we're just standing there in the middle of this place. I said, come on, let's go over here and sit in one of these first two booths. Because if the Klan is here, we don't have to look for them. They'll come to us to get us out of the booth, and then I'll inquire into where is Roger Kelly. So we went and we sat down. Nobody bothered us. Everything was cool. Nobody bothered us. Eventually, we got up, migrated over to the bar, had a soft drink there. I chatted with the guy sitting next to me like I was lost, looking for, it's right off of Route 15. How do I get back to 70, blah, blah, blah. I knew, but I was just making conversation. So he was very nice, gave me directions, and we left. Now, Mary worked out of my house. So Monday morning, the next day, she comes down to my house, and I give her Roger Kelly's phone number. I said, listen, I want you to call Roger Kelly. Call him after 5 o'clock, and, because he probably works. Give him a chance to get home. Tell him that you work for somebody who's writing a book on the Klan. Would he consent to giving me, your boss, an interview? I said, however, do not tell Mr. Kelly, that I'm black. If he agrees to the interview, he'll figure that out when he sees me, right? So she said, okay. Now, I could have called Roger Kelly myself, because I'm the one who had the phone number. I didn't want to call him, because I figured he might pick up in my voice that I'm black and say, I'm not talking to you, click, and then my whole project would have ended before it ever got started. But I knew that he would know by Mary's voice that she's white, and I knew the mentality. He would not automatically think that this white woman is working for a black man. That would not be his first train of thought, all right? So especially a black man who's writing a book on the Klan, because they did not exist. Mine is the first, all right? So she calls the guy, and she gets him and tells him, and he didn't ask what color I was, and I told her, if he asked, don't lie to him, but just don't allude to it. So he didn't ask, and he agreed to do the interview. So we set it up. Well, he essentially invited us over to his house, but we couldn't make it on that particular day, so I just told her, you know, reschedule it, make it, you know, for the motel, where the Silver Dollar Lounge is, and the motel up above the lounge. She said, okay. So the day came. Mary and I went to the motel several hours early, so because the Klan will send out little, you know, scouts to scout things out before they bring their leader. So I didn't want any of the scouts to see me, and then word get back to Roger Kelly that it's this black guy. So anyway, we get the room. I send Mary down the hall with some money to get some soda pop out of the machine and fill up the ice bucket full of ice, get the soda cold, you know, and she put it on the dresser. The way the room just happens to be, if you people are standing in the hallway and the doorway is right here, you have to come into the room, turn to your right, and the room is laid out back here. So you cannot see who's in the room from the hallway until you come in halfway and turn the corner. I took the lamp table, took the lamp off, and put the table over here in the most obscure corner of the room. I put a chair on one side for Mr. Kelly, a chair on this side for myself, right? And I had a little bag beside me that had a copy of the Bible, and I had some blank cassettes, stuck my cassette player, put it in the middle of the table so I could record the interview, all provided Mr. Kelly would come in and sit down. I had no idea what this man was going to do when he saw me. You know, he might freak out and say, I'm not talking to you, and turn around and walk away, or he might attack me, or he might come in and do what he agreed to do, was sit down and have an interview. So I'm all prepared, and I want to be hospitable and be able to offer him a beverage. So it's all getting cold over there in the ice bucket. Well, right, we set it up for 5:15, right on time and right to the minute, 5:15. I'm seated back here where you can't see me. Mary hops up, runs around the corner, opens the door. In walks what is known as the Grand Nighthawk. Nighthawk means bodyguard in Klan terminology, security. So a Grand Nighthawk would be the bodyguard for the Grand Dragon, as an Imperial Nighthawk would be the bodyguard for the Imperial Wizard. So in walks this Grand Nighthawk wearing military camouflage. He had the Ku Klux Klan insignia, that red circle, white cross, right here, blood drop. Over here were the initials KKK. On his little beret cap was embroidered Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, and right here he had a semi-automatic handgun in a holster. So he comes in, and Mr. Kelly is walking directly behind him in a dark blue suit and tie. The Nighthawk turns the corner and sees me and just freezes. Well, Mr. Kelly did not realize that his Nighthawk had stopped short. He went, he slammed into his back and knocked him forward, and they stumbled around, had to regain their balance, and they're like looking all around the room like, uh-uh, you know, either we're in the wrong room or this is an ambush. So I realized, you know, his apprehensiveness, and I stood up from my chair, and I went like this to show I had nothing in my hands, or, you know, there's no threat. I said, hi, I walked forward. I said, hi, Mr. Kelly, I'm Darryl Davis. He shook my hand. The Nighthawk shook my hand. So far, so good. I said, come on in, come on in. Have a seat. He came in. He sat down. So far, so good. The Nighthawk stood at attention to his right. And before I could sit down, Mr. Kelly says to me, Mr. Davis, do you have any form of identification? I said, sure. I gave him my driver's license. He looks at it and he goes, oh, you live on Flack Street in Silver Spring. Well, now that had me concerned. All he had to do was look at my name and look at my picture and look at me, make sure that's me, and give me back my license. You know, he doesn't need to be looking at my street. You know, I don't need him to come to my house and burn a cross in my yard or whatnot. Okay? But I did not want to let him know that he had unraveled me a little bit. But I wanted to let him know, don't come to my house and screw around, right? So I said, yes, Mr. Kelly, that is where I live. And then I recited his street address, his number, and his street. That way, I was leveling the playing field, okay? So I was letting him know, if you come visit me, I might come visit you. So let's just confine all our visiting to this motel room, right? That's what I was implying by reciting his address. He smiled and nodded his head like he understood where I was coming from. But I did not find out that day. It was many months down the road that I was being presumptuous about him. I had no reason to fear him knowing my address. What I found out was one of his members lived right down the road from my house. And so Mr. Kelly would have to come down my street to get to this guy's house. It's just pure coincidence, that's all. He has recognized the street, that's all. Today, that same member sits in a federal prison in the state of Maine for a hate crime. So anyway, so we got on with this interview. And he let me know that he did not like me, that I was inferior to him, he was superior. And but you know, he would answer my questions, some he wouldn't answer. But anyway, whenever he would say something like, well, Mr. Davis, the Bible says, you know, whatever, like, you know, blacks and whites are supposed to be separate. He claims the Bible preaches that. I'd reach down into my bag and pull out my Bible and say, here, Mr. Kelly, show me chapter and verse where it says blacks and whites must be separate. Because I've read the Bible. I've never seen that in there. So he'd flip through there and find some verse and use it to justify his point or whatever. Or if my cassette ran out of tape, I'd reach down, pull out a fresh cassette, pop it in. Well, every time I reached like this, the Nighthawk would reach like this. And after a while, he realized there was no threat in the bag. And I went in and out of the bag, no problem. A little over an hour into this interview, there was a strange noise in the room. And we all jumped. And I knew that Mr. Kelly had made this noise. I perceived it to be an ominous, threatening noise. And because I could not explain it. I knew that he made it because I didn't make it. So it had to be, you know, process of elimination. If I didn't do it, he had to have done it. So I didn't know what I had said or what I had done to cause Mr. Kelly to go off and make some weird noise. But I felt that my life was in danger. And I popped up out of my chair and hit the table because he's sitting right here in front of me. And I perceived that noise to be ominous. And all at the same time, I'm hearing that other former Klansman's voice telling me, Daryl, do not fool with Roger Kelly. Roger Kelly will kill you. And I did not want to die that day. And I'm getting ready to come across that table and grab the Nighthawk and grab Mr. Kelly and just slam them down to the ground and take away the Nighthawk's gun. Because he was the only person that I knew who had a weapon. I did not have a weapon. My secretary did not have a weapon. But I could see his weapon on his hip. I did not know if Mr. Kelly had a weapon up under his jacket or not. But I had gone into what you call survival mode. And when you go into survival mode, you do one of three things. One, some people, they will, when they get scared or whatever and they think about surviving, they tense up and they just shake. And you can be hitting them, punching them, whatever. They won't even be deflecting your blows. They're just like this, being beat on. And that's called paralysis by fear. They're so scared they can't even move. They just become immobilized. I don't do that. Second thing people will do is somebody scares them or whatever, they run away. You run away from the source of fear. That is the best option. If you can get out of there, get out of there. If something is scaring you and you fear for your life, leave, okay? But there's no outrunning a bullet in a motel room. So the third option is to attack whatever is causing you this fear, to mitigate it, to put it down before anything happens. So I had gone for the third option. And I came up and hit the table, and I'm looking right at Mr. Kelly's face, because I'm convinced that he made this noise, I know what it was. And my eyes locked with Roger Kelly's eyes. I didn't say a word to him. I knew that he could read my eyes. My eyes were speaking loud and clear. And my eyes were saying to him, what did you just do? His eyes had locked with mine. He didn't say a word. But I could read his eyes like telepathy. His eyes were saying to me, what did you just do? And the Nighthawk had his hand on his gun looking back and forth between both of us like, what did either one of y'all just do? Right? Mary was over here sitting on top of the dresser because there were no more chairs, and she realized what happened. The bucket of ice began to melt, and the cans of soda fell down, the ice. That's what made the noise. And we all began laughing at how ignorant we had been, okay? And then it made that same noise again, and we all laughed some more. This was a teaching moment. I won't say it was a learning moment. It was a teaching moment. And the lesson that was taught is this. All because some foreign, and circle the word foreign or underline it, all because some foreign entity of which we were ignorant, that being the bucket of ice and cans of soda, entered into our little comfort zone, unbeknownst to us via that noise, we became fearful of each other. Ignorance breeds fear. We fear those things we don't understand. If you don't keep that fear in check, that fear in turn will breed hatred because we hate those things that frighten us. If you don't keep that hatred in check, that hatred in turn will breed destruction. We want to destroy those things that we hate. Why? Because they scare us. But guess what? They may have been harmless and we were just ignorant. So we saw the whole chain almost unravel to completion. Completion would have been had the Nighthawk drawn his gun and shot somebody, namely me or my secretary, because it's his job to protect his boss. Or had I hurt one of them, because it's my job to protect my secretary and protect me. So fortunately, it stopped short of that. And we carried on with our interview, no more problems. You know, I went in and out of the bag, Nighthawk relaxed, he didn't bother. So at the end, I thanked Mr. Kelly, he thanked me, he shook my hand, wished me luck, and then he gave me his Klan card and said, stay in touch. I'm thinking, what? You know, I didn't say that, but that's what I was thinking. I had not come here to make friends with the Klan. I simply came to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? So I said, Mr. Kelly, I said, listen, I have a lot of other Klan people to interview around the country. However, I will give you a call when the book is ready for publication. He says, okay, good luck. He and the Nighthawk left. So Mary and I pack up. We head back down 270 towards Silver Spring. And on the way down there, I said to her, I said, you know what? I rather like Roger Kelly. She says, well, he doesn't like you. I said, well, I know. She goes, why would you like him? I said, I like him as a person, but I don't like what he stands for. Roger Kelly and I had more in common than we did in contrast. Most of what we had in contrast centered around race. He felt his race was superior to my race. I felt my race was equal to his race. He felt the races had to be apart. I felt they could be together. Other than that, we agreed on a lot of things, except when it came to racial issues. So I said, you know what? I must stay in contact with him. I began calling him. And I'm just telling you about Roger Kelly today, but you know, there are many other ones who I would talk with also. Some of them would talk to me, some of them would not talk to me, some of them wanted to fight me, and so forth and so on. But I would call Mr. Kelly, and if I had a gig up in Frederick County, I'd invite him. He'd come. He'd bring his Nighthawk. And then if I had to run an errand, I'd call him and say, hey, man, you know, what are you doing? If he said nothing, I said, well, come run this errand with me. And so he said, okay, I'll meet you at wherever. He always wanted to meet me somewhere. He didn't want me to come to his house. So we'd meet at the park and ride. He'd already be there with the Nighthawk. The Nighthawk would get in my back seat, Mr. Kelly would get in my front seat, and we'd ride around Frederick County and drop off a contract for some gig or whatever. And then I would invite him down to my house. He would drive down to my house with his Nighthawk. And the Nighthawk would sit on my couch next to him, and I'd sit across from them, you know, talking. Sometimes the Nighthawk would get bored and take out his gun and twirl it on his finger like this, right? This went on for a couple of years. Mr. Kelly did not invite me to his house. I would invite over some of my other black friends, some of my white friends, some of my Jewish friends, just to engage Mr. Kelly in a conversation with someone other than me. I wanted him to learn about other people, right? So, like I said, this went on for a couple of years. By the end of a couple years, Mr. Kelly was coming down to my house by himself. He trusted me that much. But but he didn't invite me to his house, right? After a couple years, Roger Kelly was elevated from Grand Dragon, state leader, to Imperial Wizard, national leader. He began inviting me to his house. I'd go to his house, I would see his clan den, where he'd have his clan meetings. I'd take some more notes, take some pictures from my book and things like that. And then he began inviting me to clan rallies. So I'd go to these clan rallies, I watch these clansmen and clanswomen in their robes and hoods. They had these torches with fire on them, right? And they had this 20 to 30 foot cross. The cross is stuck in the ground and it's wrapped in burlap. That the burlap has been soaked in what they call clan cologne or diesel fuel, kerosene. And then Roger Kelly would say, you know, they'd make a circle around the cross and they'd march around. And then he'd say, Klansmen, halt, and they'd all halt. Then he'd say, for God, for race, for country, blah, 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 on and on. All these views of white supremacy. He'd say, Klansmen, approach the cross. They'd all come to the center of the cross. Klansmen, light the cross. And they'd put their torches at the base of the cross. The thing would go whoosh. And then you have this big cross that's on fire. And then they'd go over here to this podium and give all kinds of lectures as what the white race needs to do in this country and how bad black people are and Jewish people and so forth and so on. So I stand there and listen to all this stuff, take some more notes, take some pictures. Well, CNN knew who I was through music. They knew who Roger Kelly was through the Klan. And they thought, you know, they'd heard about this black guy writing a book on the Klan and, you know, talking with this Klansman. So they called me and wanted to know, could they do a story? I said, sure. So they said, when's the next time you're going to a rally? I said, I'll let you know. Well, the opportunity arose, and I called them. I said, hey, I'm going to a rally on Saturday, whatever the date was. And they said, are you playing anywhere Friday night? I said, yeah, I'm playing at a place called the Vienna Tap Room down in Vienna, Virginia. And they said, we'd like to come out and film you and your band doing what you normally do to show, you know, what you do for real. And I said, okay. So I gave them the phone number to the place. They called, got permission to come there and film. And they showed up at my gig on Friday night. They filmed the band. Saturday morning, CNN came to my house. And they followed me 2 hours up the road to this Klan rally. And they said, you know, do you think Roger Kelly will even talk to us? I said, I'll do better than that. When this rally is over, I'll get Roger Kelly, the Imperial Wizard, to come back to my house. And you can interview the head of the Ku Klux Klan inside a black man's house. I said, oh, okay. So they filmed the whole rally. And when the rally was over, I spoke with Mr. Kelly. And I told him what was up. He said, yeah, he'd come back to my house. He drove 2 hours out of his way by himself, no Nighthawk, down to my house, sat in my basement, and interviewed with CNN. And this clip was shown on CNN and on Headline News, HLN, every hour for 24 hours all over the world. I'm going to show it to you right now, and I want you to pay particular attention to what Roger Kelly says. He says that even though he and I would do different things together, it did not change his views on the Klan, because his views on the Klan had been cemented in his mind for years. And then he goes on to say how he believes in separation of the races, because he finds that to be in the best interest of all races. But also listen to what he says at the very end of the clip, and then listen to what the two CNN anchor people have to say at the end of the clip. So if we can dim the lights, and there it is. Thank you. Okay. So that was the clip. And then after that, shortly thereafter, you know, my book came out and so forth and so on, and then as a result of the book, a documentary, the book came out in 97, 98, and right now I'm updating it, and it'll be out again, you know, before the year is out. But a brand new documentary just came out called Accidental Courtesy, which was shown on PBS, has been showing on PBS for the last week, and now it's on Netflix about my work. But more importantly, you heard Roger Kelly say that even though he and I would do different things together, it did not change his views on the Klan, because his views on the Klan had been what? Cemented in his mind for years, okay? And then he went on to say how he believes in separation of the races, because he finds that to be in the best interest of all races. But he said something very important towards the end. The Imperial Wizard of the Klan said that he respected me. Y'all hear him say that? Yeah. He said, we may not agree on everything, But at least he respects me to sit down and listen to me, and I respect him to sit down and listen to him. Those are his words. Very, very important. Very powerful words, people. Take those words home with you and apply them in your daily activity. That was a teaching moment. He didn't realize he was teaching anything, trust me, okay? But that was a teaching moment. If you have an opponent, an adversary, somebody with an opposing point of view, it doesn't have to be about race. Take race off the table. Any hot topic, abortion, nuclear weapons, global warming, the presidency, the war in Iraq, whatever is the hot topic, you're on one side, somebody's on the other side. Give that person a platform. Allow them to air their views, okay? No matter how extreme they may be. And believe me, at some of the rallies I've been to around this country, I have heard things so extreme they cut you to the bone, all right? But give that person a platform. Allow them to air their views. If you agree with them, fine, no problem. If you don't agree with them, that's fine too. But you challenge them, and you do it politely and intelligently, not violently or rudely. You say, look, I hear what you're saying, but I need a little more clarification. Give me some more explanation as to why you think I should believe the way you believe. And when you do things like that, there is an excellent chance that they will reciprocate and give you a chance to give your platform and explain your point of view. Make sure that you have done your homework so you have all your facts together so you can explain your platform in an intelligent and influential manner. Because at the end of the day, you each have to think about what the other person said. And if somebody says something to you that creates a little spark, but it goes against what you have believed from day one to however old you may be today, but that little spark happens, you think, you know, she does have a point there. You might begin leaning in that direction. It might not be an overnight shift, but maybe a gradual shift, okay? You want to start that conversation. The problem with people today, this person will go on CNN and talk about that person and bash that person. Then that person goes on Fox News and talks about that person who went on CNN and start bashing him. And then they both appear on MSNBC and they talk at each other. So people are either talking about each other or at each other. Nobody is sitting down talking with each other. That's the problem. I am willing to go and sit down and talk with somebody who does not agree with me. And believe me, I hear all kinds of crazy stuff, okay? But I got the patience, you know, get it all out. Tell me what, you know, what you're thinking. I will talk with you. As a result, now understand something. I did not respect what Roger Kelly had to say. I did not respect what he had to say. I'm not a supremacist. I'm not a separatist. I'm not a racist. All right? I did not respect what he had to say, but I respected his right to say it. You understand the difference? Okay. As we would do that, even after my book came out, I would get together with him and go out and have dinner and talk about different things. Sometimes it'd be about the Klan, but not always. Talk about the latest movie that we each saw or whatever. We would talk with each other. Over time, that cement that he talked about that held his ideology together and his ideas in his mind that was cemented in there that he talked about began to get cracks in it. And then after a little more time, those cracks began to crumble and that ideology fell apart. And then just a few years back, Roger Kelly quit the Ku Klux Klan. Today, he no longer believes and what he said on that video. When Roger Kelly quit the Ku Klux Klan, he gave me his robe and hood. This is the robe of the Imperial Wizard. It's the same robe that you saw him wearing in that video clip. I got upside down here. Here we go. You know, I'm not used to wearing these things. All right. Okay. That's the robe of the Imperial Wizard. There is the Klan emblem. It's called a Mayoke or a blood drop emblem. All right? And you can have either a cotton robe, white cotton robe, blue or purple, your choice, are the Imperial colors. So if you're an Imperial Wizard or Imperial Klayla or Imperial whatever, You would have a white cotton robe with a blue stripes, a blue cape, a blue sash, or purple, your choice. Or you'd have, if you prefer satin over cotton, you would have a full blue satin robe or full purple satin robe. Okay? And of course, this is known as the hood or the helmet. They also call it a helmet. This is the hood or the helmet. This is the mask. Members who want anonymity, they don't want you to know who they are, they wear this mask and peep at you through these eyelets so they can see you, but you can't see them. The mask has three snaps. If they don't care that you know who they are, they just unsnap the mask, pull it off, and the face is exposed under the hood. And you saw both types in that video, people with their faces exposed, people with their faces covered, all right? Now, how did I get this? I did not go on the media or whatever and bash the Klan, talk about how bad they are, or talk at them and say, look, you know, you all need to just give me your robes and get out of this thing. No, it came from talking with somebody. This man started out hating me, not liking me, and feeling superior to me, all right? But through dialogue, talking with people, I never set out to convert anybody. I just set out to find out, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? And through the course of dialogue, he figured out that he couldn't hate me. He had no reason to. And he began shifting that ideology. That cement began to crumble. And when he got out of the Klan, I got his robe. Now, here's a byproduct. The state of Maryland had a large contingency of membership of Ku Klux Klan members. Today, there is no more Ku Klux Klan in the state of Maryland as a result of the leader and I becoming friends. All right? Now, that does not mean that there are no more racists in Maryland. Trust me, I see them every day. I keep getting pulled over by some of them. But there are plenty of racists in Maryland, all right? But there's no more organized racism. A couple people have tried to revitalize the Klan, and three or four of them will announce they're going to hold a Klan rally and start the Klan again, hold a rally at the Confederate battlefield up in Sharpsburg, Maryland. And everybody comes there to see them, and only three or four of them show up, and two of them are drunk. So that does not constitute an organized Klan, all right? Now, this green is the grand level color. This robe, white cotton robe with the green cape and green stripes, etc., belonged to an active grand dragon in the Klan who became my friend and left. You see his dragon patch right here and his Klan emblem right there. Green sash, green stripes, green cape. Under the cape is another dragon patch. This grand dragon here, he preferred satin. So he had a full green satin robe. And he wore two of the blood drop emblems. And got his little Confederate flag on his arm here. This guy, Robert White, Bob White. When I was in my late teens, I heard on WTOP, the local news station, that Grand Dragon of Maryland, Robert White, had been arrested. And he was being charged with conspiring to bomb a synagogue in Baltimore, Maryland, up on Liberty Road, the Liberty Road Synagogue, okay? And so he got arrested. He did 4 years in prison. He still ran the Klan from within the prison through his grand clalif on the outside. When he got out, he continued running the Klan. Some years later, he got busted again. This time for assault with intent to murder two black men with a shotgun over in Woodlawn, Maryland, right outside of Baltimore. He got 3 years in prison. Well, you know, when you're in the Klan, you don't make a lot of money, unless you're a leader, and even then you don't make a whole lot of money. You get a small stipend out of the dues. Being a Klan leader, Grand Dragon, Imperial Wizard, whatever, is just a title, like Boy Scout leader or something like that. You don't get paid for it. So, you know, it's like a volunteer kind of thing. You have to have a regular day job. This man's day job Baltimore City police officer. This is his uniform. He was not an undercover cop in the Klan. He was a bona fide Klansman on the police force. Got me? Okay. He gave me these because he and I became friends, and I tour all over the country giving lectures. Bob White went on to become one of my best friends, and he came to my wedding. And he renounced, I would say, 98%. You know, he had a little more work to do. But hey, that's a start. That's a start, okay? People can change. People can change. One of the, this is a Klan rally banner. They fly when they march or have their rallies. There. This came from another Klan group. And did you all follow the news the other day where this the leader of the largest Klan group in the country was murdered the other day? He was a friend of mine as well. He was on the verge of getting out. He wasn't out. He was on the verge of getting out. His name was Frank Ancona. And I went to his funeral last week. And today I own his robe as well. It's at home. But this is a Klan t-shirt. It's probably one of the most despicable things that I have. You know, the Ku Klux Klan hated Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was about bringing everybody together. The Klan is about getting everybody apart, right? So on Martin Luther King Day and on April 4th, the day that King was assassinated, which the Klan calls James Earl Ray Day, in honor of the man who was convicted of assassinating King. Now, I won't get into all that tonight, but personally, I do not believe that James Earl Ray killed Dr. King, and neither does the King family. When James Earl Ray was in prison, I would write him letters, and I figured, you know, he had nothing better to do than read my letters and write me back, and that's exactly what he did. We had a correspondence. I still have his letters at home. James Earl Ray was definitely a racist, no question about it. His brother, Jerry Ray, was in the Klan down in Alabama. But James Earl Ray did not kill King. James Earl Ray was set up. Anyway, they wear these t-shirts on Martin Luther King Day and on James Earl Ray Day. And it depicts a picture of Dr. King with the crosshairs, the bullseye of a shotgun on his forehead, mocking his I Have a Dream speech. And it says, "Our dream came true." Okay? Why do I have these things? Why am I keeping these things? I'm glad I have these things because the fact that I have them means that the people who wore these no longer wear them. And it means that they no longer believe in what those things stand for. It bothers me a great deal that we as Americans call ourselves the greatest nation on the face of this earth. Don't get me wrong. I love my country. I'm patriotic. But I have some issues with that statement. Maybe we are the greatest technologically. We have the ability in this country, and we've proven it, to put a man on the moon. We're the first ones to do that. And while Neil Armstrong was up there walking around, talking about one small step for man and one giant leap for mankind, we talked to him live from right here on Earth all the way to the moon. Via satellite radio phone. We invented that technology. Everybody in here has a cell phone. Everybody in here has email. Hit a few words, hit a few numbers, hit send, and you're talking to people right next door in Maryland or California, Africa, China, Australia, wherever you want to talk. We invented that technology. How is it that we Americans can talk to people as far away as the moon or anywhere on the face of this earth, yet some of us cannot talk to the person who lives right next door to our house because he or she is a different color, a different persuasion, a different religion? It seems to me that before we can call ourselves the greatest nation on the face of this earth, our ideology needs to catch up to our technology. And once we get them both up there, then we can truly brag about how great we are. We are living in the 21st century, folks. Why is this stuff still around? We are living in space age times, but some of us are still thinking with stone age minds. And we can change that. Listen, what did I say I majored in? Music, okay? I did not major in sociology or psychology. I probably should have. I probably make more money doing that than I do playing music. But I love music. Anyway, I'm just a rock and roll piano player, folks. So if I can sit down and talk with somebody and walk away with things like that, any of us can do that by talking with people. The two CNN anchor people, they said, they implied that I was strange. If being strange gets people to give up that stuff, we all need to be strange. Okay? Thank you. Now, I'm going to take some questions, but before I do that, I don't remember what song I was playing in 1983 that caused the Klansman to get up from his table and walk across the dance floor and embrace me and talk about Jerry Lee Lewis and all that kind of stuff. I do remember the style. And I will demonstrate it for you. This is rock and roll, boogie woogie, rockabilly. This is what I played with Chuck Berry for about 32 years. I played piano with him, the man who invented rock and roll. Without Chuck Berry, you would not have Elvis Presley or the Beatles or the Rolling Stones or Led Zeppelin or anybody, for that matter, who plays rock music. Like I said, I don't remember the song, but I do remember the style. Can I get just a little bit more volume in the monitors? That's good, thank you. Okay, a little boogie-woogie for you. Make it up as I go. Where I come from, we call this whipping the keys. Chuck Berry, he said like this. Okay, thank you. So, thank you. So that's what I do for real, not chase the Klan around. All right. All right, any questions? Yes, ma'am.
Hi.
Hi. What you do is you get active. You get out there and don't, you know, people make the habit of forming groups, anti-racist groups, okay? So, you know, you and I are anti-racist, and these two people right here are anti-racist. So, hey, let's get together and form a group, and we're going to meet the second Wednesday of every month and talk about how bad racism is, okay? We're not solving anything because You're not telling me anything that I don't already know. I'm not telling you anything that you don't already know. What we need to do is we need to invite the racist to come over and talk to us.
But I don't want to spend time with them, sir.
But here, that's... I hear what you're saying. She says she does not want to spend time with them, okay? I understand that completely. Trust me. People don't have patience for that, okay? I understand that. But that's why it is still around, okay? We have to be patient. We have to spend time with these people because you know the way, you know how it's supposed to be. They don't. So educate them. Teach them. Okay, I'll put it this way. People say to me, Daryl, how do you have that kind of patience? I can't sit down and talk to somebody, you know, that ignorant and who's going to sit there and offend me and insult me. You know what? If you go to your doctor and your doctor says, Samantha, I hate to tell you this, but you are in the beginning stages of breast cancer. I'm going to need to put you through an 8-week regimen of chemotherapy or radiation or what have you.
I'm very familiar. My dad just died of cancer.
Okay, but you can't say, I don't have time for that. You know, I don't have the patience to go through 8 weeks of this stuff. No, you better. Okay, otherwise it's going to take you out. All right, we have to have that kind of patience to learn from one another. Yes. You hold your temper and let them get it all out. Now, there are going to be people who are never going to change, okay? There'll be people who will go to their grave being hateful, violent, and ugly, and some of them will not change, okay? But there will be those who will change, and you could be the impetus for that change. I'm just a rock and roll piano player. I'm not a sociologist or scholar, but if I can sit down.
There is not money in that.
Okay, you're a social worker. All right, but be patient. Learn as much as you can about their point of view. Right? And then go and talk to them. Because you already know where it's supposed to be. They don't. And they can learn from you. There will be those who you talk to who do change, and there will be those who don't. But if you change one person, you can change a generation.
But what if somebody sees me to them and thinks that about me?
Don't be afraid of what people think. Listen, you go on Facebook or social media or wherever, there are pictures of me all over the place shaking hands with Klansmen or neo-Nazis or whatever, and I get all kinds of flack. That visceral reaction, okay? Because some people don't think, what's going on here? Let me try to find out the story. They just attack me. Watch the movie, Accidental Courtesy. You'll see me being attacked, and you'll see what happens.
Okay.
All right.
Actually, I wanted to ask you about that, because you do get attacked by leaders from the African American.
That's right.
And so have you continued that dialogue with them?
Yes, and as a matter of fact, the person who initiated the attack, he and I are now friends. From sitting down and talking. Anyone else? Yes, sir.
Did you ever get an answer to your question?
No, because there is no answer. You know, how can you hate me when you don't even know me? I keep asking the question, and when they figure out they can't hate me, I want the same things for my family as they want for theirs. We speak the same language. We bleed the same way. Thank you. But I'm still looking for the answer.
Sir, question up here?
Yes. Okay, the guy was asking, how about my faith in God and Jesus Christ? How did it get me through this process? Absolutely. Absolutely. I was guided and I was protected. I tell you what, I've been in some hairy situations. But let me tell you an interesting story about that. The Ku Klux Klan claims to be a Christian organization, okay? And, you know, they don't represent the Christianity that I know, okay? And we got to be careful how we judge religions. A lot of us, I won't say us necessarily, but a lot of people are anti-Islam. There's a certain sect of Islam that is bad. There's a certain sect of Christianity that is bad. Okay? But don't paint every religion with a broad brush, because there are plenty of people, Islamic people, Christian people, Jewish people, etc., who are great people. But we all have certain sects within various religions that are destructive and counterproductive. So let's be careful that we don't paint a broad brush. But the Klan claims to be a Christian organization. So one day I had this exalted Cyclops in my car. And I drive him around. So I'm driving him around, right? And he's sitting over here. And we're talking. And we got somehow on the topic of burning a cross. And I said to the guy, I said, look, man, you claim to be a Christian organization. Why are you burning the cross? Isn't that blasphemous? Isn't it sacrilegious? Oh, no, Daryl, we are a Christian organization. He goes, we use fire on the cross for two purposes. One, fire signifies purity. He said, did you ever get a splinter in your finger and your mom took a needle and heated it up with a match, put it on the stove, and then dug it out? I said, yeah. And he says, well, she was purifying the tip of the needle to make it clean to go inside and dig out the splinter. I said, okay. He goes, so fire, we use it symbolically to symbolize purity, the purity of the white race. Then he goes, the second reason we use fire on the cross is because we are a Christian organization and we are lighting the way for Jesus Christ. And I said, wait a minute, hold on. I said, you must have a different Jesus Christ than I have. He goes, no, Daryl, there's only one Jesus Christ. I said, no, there are two. He says, no, there's one. I said, no, there are two. He goes, what, is your Jesus Christ black or something? I said, well, no, he's not black. I said, but he's not white either. I said, the area in which he appeared over like in Syria, Damascus area, I said, I've been there. I said, he appeared as one of those people. And the people that I saw there are olive-complected. So if anything, he was olive-complected. And he said, well, what's your point? I said, my point is, like I said, you got a Jesus Christ and I got one. He goes, no, there's only one. I said, well, how do you figure? And he says, well, because there's only one Jesus Christ. I said, well, you said that you're lighting the way for your Jesus Christ. He said, yes. He says, if you're a Christian like you say you are, you would know that Jesus Christ is coming back. I said, yeah. I said, I know that. He's coming back. I said, but here's the difference. You have to light the way for your Jesus Christ. My Jesus Christ lights the way for me. Who are you to light the way for Jesus Christ? And he got very quiet. But you could tell his wheels were like spinning. And then he changed the subject. Okay? In less than 5 months, this guy quit the Ku Klux Klan based on that ridiculous conversation. Okay? And I have his robe. Yes, ma'am.
Hi. First of all, thanks for coming to the event.
Thank you for having me. Okay, what you do is you start off with your conversation, say, look, let's be completely honest with each other. Say, there are going to be some things that I might say that you might construe as being offensive. I don't want you to think I'm being racist. I'm sitting here talking to you because I want to learn something from you, and I want you to learn something from me so we can address each other. This is not a debate. This is a conversation in which we both can learn. So let's not accuse one another. Let's be open and honest. Turn all our cards face up on the table and have an honest conversation. That's the only way we can ever reach anything. That's how you lay down the ground rules first. Sir?
What was the circumstances that
because we have this class called the POTC, Problems of the 20th Century, and our teacher would just invite controversial people to our school. And so he was just some controversial person. They had the American Nazi Party. And he came and spoke. We had some other different speakers from different topics, things like that. I thought it was a great experience. I really did. Of course, today it would not be what's called politically correct, what I don't believe in. But anyway, I'm glad I had that experience because it put me on a trajectory to find out some answers. Yes, ma'am. Right.
How do you recommend that we address race with our children today?
I would say address it, okay? I would say have those conversations. But understand, where I was living overseas, I wasn't seeing any racism. They would not have been able to explain it to me because I was getting along with people from all over the world. I mean, like, what are you talking about? You know, this person might not like me because he's from Asia, or he's from South America, or whatever, or he's white, or whatever. So, but I think had I been living here, and my dad not been in the Foreign Service, oh, I think we would have had that talk, you know, a lot earlier, and I would have known about it. So I would always advise, you know, don't hide things, you know, tell them to be respectful of anybody and everybody, okay? But have that talk with them. Yes. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, what did you say?
How did they listen to you?
They listened to me very well when they gave me those things. But, we would sometimes, you know, we would argue. And because, you know, they have believed certain things for a long time, and people just don't change overnight. But as long as you remain calm, cool, and collected, and you be polite to people, chances are they will listen. And what you want to do is you want to learn as much as you can about the other person. Because even if they don't like you, as soon as they see that you know about them, they begin to respect you, okay? And see, there are two things. There are people who are ignorant, and there are people who are stupid. And some people define ignorance and stupidity as being synonymous. I do not. For me, an ignorant person is someone who makes the wrong decision or a bad choice, because he or she does not have the facts to make the right choice or the correct decision. If you give that person that information, give them the facts, they can make the right choice, all right? A stupid person is someone who has the facts, who has the right information, and still makes the wrong choice. So I'll give you an example. If I have a room, and I paint all the walls in the room, and I do not put up signs that say wet paint, stay off the walls, anybody coming into that room is ignorant as to the fact that the walls are wet. And they might go and lean up against the wall and get paint on their clothes because they didn't know, they were ignorant. I can fix that ignorance by putting up signs, putting out the proper facts, the information. Put up signs that say wet paint, stay off the walls. I can stand in the doorway and tell each person coming into that room, hey, gather around the center. Don't get close to the walls. I just painted them 10 minutes ago. They're still wet. So now everybody has the facts. Everybody has the proper information. But still, somebody goes and leans up against the wall, and then he wants to know why he has paint on his clothes. It's because he's stupid. Okay? He had the information. He didn't use it. Fortunately, there is a cure for ignorance. That cure is called education.
Amen.
That's right. Okay? You give somebody the education, you alleviate their ignorance. Unfortunately, there is no cure for stupidity. Okay? If you give somebody the education and they don't use it, there's nothing you can do until they use it. Yes? I'm sorry?
Why did you keep the robes?
Why do I keep the robes? Is that what you said? Okay. The Ku Klux Klan is as American as baseball, apple pie, and Chevrolet. Okay? It is a shameful an ugly part of our history, but it is still our history. And we do not destroy our history. One day I'm going to open a museum. I have a ton of stuff back home. And I'm going to put these things in a museum. It'll be a living museum. People can come and see these things and talk about them. I'll have ex-Klan members come and give lectures, etc. Okay, that's why I have these things. You don't destroy American history. It's just like the Holocaust Museum. We need that so we can see what happened, okay, to 6 million Jewish people. We have the African American Museum so we can see what happened. We need also to see about this. It's shameful, it's ugly, but it is part of our history. That's why I have them. Yes?
I want to thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
I'm honored to be speaking.
My pleasure. Thank you.
My brother is a police officer.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be remiss if I did not say that just like people make broad statements about different races,
right?
I think that sometimes in today's society, broad statements are made about the law enforcement.
Right.
Protect and serve us.
Right. We all do.
And we all do. And it's just so easy for us to point our fingers at other people and just group everybody in at one time.
Yes. And let me address that, too, if I may. My father was a law enforcement agent before he was a foreign service agent. My father was one of the first black Secret Service agents ever hired by the Secret Service. They hired 5 black men at one time. My father was one of those 5. And he rose as high as they would. My father wanted to be an FBI agent. J. Edgar Hoover, the top law enforcement agent in this country, was a racist, as you know. Okay, he did not hire black people, he did not hire women, all right? So he would not hire my father. The Secret Service did hire my father, and my father traveled all over the world busting drug dealers. He worked for the Secret Service Division of the BNDD, which stood for Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. In 1976, the Bureau split in half, and half became DEA, the other half became ATF. They were born out of the BNDD, all right? It reached a point where my father was training police officers and training other agents who were getting promoted above him because there was a ceiling on how high blacks could go. I have a great deal of respect for law enforcement because that's what he taught me. Unfortunately, there's not a mechanism by which police officers who do put their lives on the line for all of us, each and every day of their lives, to be able to report on other officers who are abusing their authority. People often want to separate the police into 2 categories, good cops and bad cops. Well, I'm here to tell you there are 3 categories. We all know what a bad cop does. A good cop will not tell on the bad cop. The good cop may not participate in those activities, but they have a blue wall of silence, a blue code of silence, where they don't tell on their fellow officer. The 3rd category is the honest cop, and the honest cop is the minority. The honest cop will tell on the bad cop, and as a result, that honest cop jeopardizes his or her own safety from their fellow officers. You know, they might go on a call and they need backup, and all the cops know that person snitched, they don't respond, all right? Like you all have seen the movie Serpico. Serpico was an honest cop. When the police are at a loss for information because there's been a murder or rape or whatever, and they can't figure it out, they often advertise, you know, call in this number anonymously, give us a tip, et cetera, et cetera. And people do that, and that way, oftentimes, these crimes are solved through these anonymous tips. The police need a mechanism by which they can be protected as well, so when they see one of their own misbehaving or whatever, they can call a number or something anonymously and report it without any ramifications coming in on them. And that would solve a lot of problems. That would also build up trust that we have with the police, because it just takes one bad cop to do something and then everybody thinks the whole department is bad. And that's not the case. That's not the case at all. But if there are that many good cops out there, and honest cops out there, which there may be, then they need to come together and say, hey, look, we need to get rid of these people who are making us a bad reputation. So they need that mechanism in place. So that way we build trust with the community.
But is that not how stereotypes are formed? If a black man robs someone, then it makes the whole black community look bad.
Sure, absolutely.
And, you know, I'm on the metro every day going to work, and I get called all kinds of names all the time by people of different races because I'm a white man. And the one privilege I have that we all have is that Jesus Christ died for all of us.
That's right. And that's why you remain calm, cool, and collected, and not be like, what's the guy's name, Bernard Goetz, who got called all kinds of names on the New York Metro subway and shot, you know, four people. So you keep that faith, okay? And don't be afraid to talk to people, you know? Because, you know, you cannot beat the hate out of somebody. That's impossible. You know, you beat on them, all you're doing is emboldening and enforcing that hate. Okay, folks, thank you all very, very much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Aaron's going to take you to the lobby so you can meet everyone.
Okay, all right, sure. Thank you. Thank you. Huh? Yeah, I'll go ahead and pack
up. Hey, everybody, if you could hold a second. Daryl wants to get out to the lobby before you. He's very gracious and would love to shake your hands if you'd like to. We have some refreshments for you out there as well. So Aaron's just going to take Daryl out there, and you'll have a chance to meet. Thanks so much for being here tonight. We appreciate it. Have a wonderful evening.